Or while I'm speaking, if you would like, it would be. We are going to go to noon today, but let me assure you that I'm not going to lecture at you the whole time. We will take a break midstream. Also, I want to invite you at various points for interaction. We'll hopefully even save a little time at the end for questions and discussion and rebuttals. Before we get started, last night we watched a compressed version of Matt Fitzgerald's sermon to his justice-involved, fairly left-leaning congregation in Chicago on the Sunday after Donald Trump was inaugurated. And they were expecting a kind of condemnation sermon of the new president and all that the new president stood for. But Fitzgerald surprised them with a sermon that had kind of three moves to it. You may remember it started off with the description of a series of Roman emperors described in clearly Trump-like terms, and each of those followed by the refrain, Jesus never mentioned him. He was about his father's business. Then the center section of the sermon was a discussion of the Barman Declaration, not as a direct address to Nazism or Hitler, but as an affirmation of Jesus Christ as Lord, and a call by Fitzgerald for his congregation in this trying time to be the church. Third section. I know you're disappointed. Those of you who have come here today with the passion of your politics. But let me tell you an irony. When the church continues to be the church, the world perceives it as political. Then he gave them a series of illustrations from their own history. I gave you one where they were ministering to the people fleeing the 1968 Democratic National Convention, bleeding, and how the church, even though they may not have sympathized with their politics, ministered to them because they were bleeding and they were about their father's business. Now, this is not the only approach to the current events and the political situation that this pastor takes. Some months later, when Jeff Sessions quoted Romans 13 as a justification for separating children from their parents at the border, Fitzgerald directly addressed that. How dare one of the most powerful men politically in America use our scripture to oppress children? So he takes a variety of approaches, but I'm interested in your response to that one we saw last night. Let's start with the positives, if you saw those. What do you think was good about what he did in his approach? Anybody, what do you think was good? Yeah. Okay, he called us to our practices. Good. What else was good about it, did you think? Yes?
He had a tagline that brought us back every time. He was about his father's.
That hit like a drum beat all the way through. And in fact, if we'd watched the conclusion, that would be the concluding line. Yes?
He was deeply theological.
Ah, yes, I knew you would like that. Yeah, the very fact that the sermon was angular in regard to the expectation of the congregation at first created perhaps perplexity, and then it ended up potentially opening up a different way of looking at things. Anybody else? Yes. Yeah, I'm going to just pick one line out of what you said, and that was, I liked the fact that he brought actual historical research to bear as a resource on the sermon. It wasn't simply devotional musings on the scripture, but there was some learning and gathering so that the sermon spread out beyond, like Psalm 19, it went out into the world and then came back into the sanctuary. Yes.
Many of our congregations are politically divided today. So his example provides a way of going about preaching the gospel without making the congregation then turn on each other, but to focus on what Jesus taught us to do.
Potentially, he did not exacerbate the political divisions that are probably there in most of our congregations by pointing out, if any of us, regardless of our politics, are looking for politics as the ultimate source of meaning, we are committing a kind of idolatry. Let's get back to the living God. One last one, and then I want to, well, two. There are two here. Let's get yours. Yeah, it had emotional content, both in terms of tugging at our heartstrings, but in pieces like, after what he had done, he was gloomy. It was hard to walk the halls of the palace when you knew what you had done to your own family. Yeah, that sort of emotional intensity. Yeah. In this kind of environment, doing what we do when we're about God's business is absolutely countercultural and has a valence that we might not have known about. Were there any criticisms that you would want to lift up about what our preacher did last night? Anything you saw that rubbed you the wrong way or that he might have done better? Any? Yes. Herod's out to get you, they told him. You go tell that fox. I work today, I'm working tomorrow, I'm working the day after. Now, so what we have here is a homiletical insight and rule, I think. If we can anticipate that what we are saying will have some people in the congregation who say, hey, wait a minute, what about? Or, yeah, you're just arguing from silence, that's a weak argument. Then that's an elephant in the room and needs to be addressed. If, however, your guesstimate is there's maybe nobody who feels that way or there's one person who feels that way, you can handle that at the door. If it's a stray hearing, not to relegate, I mean, I had the same feeling you do. You and I are together. We're both going to be dealt with at the door. But you just assess the reaction to what you're saying, and if it is a significant demur, then you send a sheepdog out to deal with it somewhere in the sermon. Other yeah. Yeah, the Women's March.
And it was very emotional and I think effective, but I also thought part of it was remind this congregation, oh, by the way, I do agree with you. And I wonder if the argument that the rest of the sermon made could have been more powerful and challenging without the little wink to the side, oh, and I'm one of you, by the way. And I think maybe he just needed to do that personally.
That's,
and keep him on his side.
No, that's an interesting response. You heard what might have been an attempt on his part to say, if you're disappointed and have passion, I have passion too. I identify with you as a kind of failure of nerve, maybe. Hey, wait a minute. Don't get me wrong. I'm on your side about this. That's an interesting. Any other? Yes. Okay, all right. The barman thing would have sent you off a different stream. Yes.
I think
context, context, context. If I had preached that to the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church in McCormick, South Carolina, what they would have heard is, whew, it's all about piety. If I had preached that, or as he preached it, in the St. Paul's United Church of Christ in South Chicago, there's no danger that they're ever going to hear that the gospel's not political, since that's the main theme of most of the rest of the things that they do. But that's an excellent observation. We'll stop here with that, but I think one of the things that preachers need to develop, and maybe many of you already have, is a sense of self-forgiveness about sermons. Honestly speaking, there is this diversity of reaction almost every Sunday going on out there. And maybe this is a male trait more than a woman preacher's trait, but there is often the sense that we are seeking a kind of unblemished perfection that everyone in the congregation would vote yes to our sermon. And I think we forgive ourselves partly with the notion there is next Sunday, and the next Sunday, and the next Sunday, and what we finally accomplish or are judged on is the body of our preaching work and not to the responses to one particular sermon. And maybe this is just a personal confession, but as a young pastor, I used to go home and beat myself up if I received criticism at the door for anything that I said. I shouldn't have done that. I should have done something different. And it's unavoidable that there will be a diversity of opinion among responsive folks. Yeah.
I know lots of women who are perfectionists and beat themselves up about many things, but I don't think it being a male or a female trait is particularly relevant.
Okay. You may be right about that. I was just claiming it out of my own sense of masculinity about that. All right. Thanks for responding to that. Every 50 or 75 years, American preaching has a nervous breakdown. And what I mean by that is that those of us who are preaching begin to sense that they aren't listening to us, that our preaching is not connecting in the way that it once did, the way we have been taught, and the way as a group of ministers practice preaching is not connecting with our culture. My colleague at Emory, Ted Smith, has written a beautiful book about a nervous breakdown in American preaching that occurred in the first third of the 19th century. In those days, American preachers would be like orators or lawyers or actors. The style of public elocution was to use very poetic and flowery language and to accentuate that with exaggerated gestures. The preacher would be like an actor on the stage. Now, everybody knew that you didn't talk that way at home. Nobody goes into the breakfast table, "My dear, I would like a piece of toast." But it was appropriate to talk that way in public. That's the way public orators talked. But then something changed in the cultural sensorium, that suddenly the difference between the public and private self became stressed and unacceptable. We don't know exactly what caused the change, but a genius, communicational genius, by the name of Charles Grandison Finney, sensed the change and, as an evangelist, began to develop a new form of American preaching. He figured out that he could be much more persuasive as an evangelist if he would stop using the flowery language and use the garden variety everyday speech. He sensed that he should not use the large public gesture, and he developed a way of simply speaking with the small gesture and the shrug and the expression on the face that you would use in ordinary conversation. He then said, "I think I'll just get rid of the pulpit altogether." And he began to wander around the chancel so that he could get personal one-to-one eye contact listeners. Then he even began to design sanctuaries with sight lines so that you could make that kind of one-to-one contact. And suddenly, into the vocabulary of American preaching, there came a new quality: sincerity. Now, we think that's always been there since Jesus. Jesus was surely sincere. Actually, it's a product in American preaching of the first third of the 19th century, and young pastors began to imitate Finney. Now, when you imitate sincerity, it begins to break down fairly quickly. But it is in the DNA of American preaching. It is a straight line in some ways from Charles Finney to Joel Osteen. He stands there, and Osteen, and preaches bromides, but he's so sincere, and the sincerity has a power about it. Now, this changed not only the way preachers preached, it changed the way Americans talked in public. Here are the first few words of the address given at the Gettysburg Cemetery by the speaker of the day, Edward Everett. Standing beneath this serene sky, overlooking these broad fields now reposing from the labors of the waning year, the mighty Alleghenies dimly towering before us, the graves of our brethren beneath our feet, it is with hesitation that I raise my poor voice to break the eloquent silence of God and nature, but the duty to which you have called me must be performed. Grant me, I pray you, your indulgence and your sympathy. 13,000 words, and 2 hours later, he finished, and then stood up Abraham Lincoln. Listen to this. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We're met on a great battlefield of that war. We've come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that our nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. 271 words altogether. And it's not simply the difference between a simple, common form of address. It represents a change in the rhetoric of America. Lincoln spoke like an honest man would speak in a one-to-one conversation, and it had a power that escaped Edward Everett. Now, we had another nervous breakdown right after World War II. Right after World War II, American preaching was what you might call highly didactic. The idea of preaching was to take a biblical text, to boil it down to its central theological truth, to divide that into logical parts, and then to teach that to the congregation. We caricature that as 3 points and a poem, but it wasn't far from that. When Interpretation Magazine in 1997 had its 50th anniversary, this is the biblical journal that's published out of Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, they asked Rick Lisher, homiletician at Duke, to give an address on the changes in preaching that had happened since Interpretation had been founded. And so what Lisher did was to read and listen to the tapes of sermons from preachers in 1947. And as a part of his lecture, he said, the sermons breathe a sense of confidence in the clarity and rationality of the Christian faith. This is a message that makes sense, they say, and it's going to get through to you. If you've listened to tapes from that period, you may have noticed that preachers sound terribly sure of themselves, even pompous. Partly because they are under no necessity to qualify their assertions. There's an ease of communication here that's disconcerting to our ears. They reflect a world that has been restored by the forces of good, World War II. They rejoice in the unlimited capacity of humanity to master its future. But most of all, They assume a universe of shared values and common language for expressing them. And then, after World War II, we were wearing coonskin caps and watching color TV and twirling hula hoops and driving Thunderbirds, and pastors began to sense they're not listening to me. They're there, the churches are full, but they're not listening to me. And an emergency call went out, and what was born in this nervous breakdown of preaching was what we were all taught in this room. It's called the New Homiletic. It's 70 years old and on a walker, but it's the New Homiletic. And it was pioneered by homileticians who went over to Europe and studied a new wrinkle in biblical studies called the New Hermeneutic. Now, the New Hermeneutic grew out of Heidegger on the philosophical side and Bultmann on the New Testament side. But basically, it saw language not simply as instruments of communication, but as the house of being. And when you went into a text, it had the capacity to create a new world of being and meaning. In fact, the slogan of the New Hermeneutic was, "You don't interpret the text interprets you." And what these homileticians brought back was a notion that sermons are not messages. That was a synonym for sermons in those days. What's your message going to be this morning, Pastor? They weren't messages, they were events. And so we began to design sermons that would create experiences rather than teaching, point one, point two, point three. And our primary method for doing so was narrative. Now, I'm willing to wager that most of the preachers in this room are to some degree and in some way narrative preachers. I certainly am. I have relished it. I have taught it. I'll probably die a narrative preacher. But narrative preachers assemble stories of everyday life and connect them with the text in hopes that there can be a powerful eruption of meaning and event, so that if people are moved by the sermon, that's the measure of a good sermon, rather than, "I learned something this morning, Pastor." In a sense, the move toward narrative, the move toward event in the New Homiletic was like an event that happened in art 100 years earlier, when Felix Turnachain, in his gallery in Paris, had an exhibition of new artists by the name of Monet, Manet, Pissarro, Renoir. He did not realize that it would cause a riot in the streets. The police had to be called out for the first exhibition of these new painters. The art critic for the Paris Evening Match sniffed, "These aren't artists, they're mere impressionists." And the label stuck. Now, what caused the impressionist style to upset people was not simply that the old masters painted the great stories and myths, and these impressionists painted music lessons and picnics beside the Seine, everyday life. It wasn't just that the old masters had clear, bold colors and lines, and these new artists had gauzy, stippled styles. What caused the panic was that the new artists shifted the authority for meaning from the painter to the viewer. And what was happening in American preaching was a shifting of the meaning of the sermon from the pages on the pulpit that the preacher brought to the listener. This is a massive turn to the listener. And I don't know if you have experienced what I've experienced of the excitement of this, the capacity of telling everyday stories as holy encounters. Well, now, narrative preaching is taking on water, and it is being roundly criticized from the right the left, and the middle. The evangelical right was the last to warm up to narrative preaching, and it's the first to cool down. And James Thompson, who teaches at Abilene Christian University, an evangelical school, has written a brilliant book called Preaching Like Paul. And Preaching Like Paul argues against me, Fred Craddock, Barbara Brown Taylor, and all the narrative preachers in America who've ever taught and practiced it. And what James Thompson says is, narrative preaching is weak ethically, limp theologically, incapable of exercising evangelism, and absolutely incompetent in building Christian community. Other than that, it's fine. he said, they don't recognize we're in a missionary situation, and we need to preach like we're in a missionary situation, and it's going to require preaching like Paul. The middle, and I'm thinking of Chuck Campbell at Duke, say, you know the problem with the kind of narrative preaching we've been doing? It has been, like Craddock, inductive, but it never really was inductive. It was really eductive. It was always dependent upon a moribund Christian faith already out there that needed to be awakened. But what if you're looking at blank tablets? What if there's nothing to awaken out there? What if we are in a secular society? Then narrative preaching is simply titillating, but not formative. The left has been the last to weigh in, but they've been the harshest. I've been thinking about John McClure at Vanderbilt, who says, let me tell you what's wrong with Tom Long's preaching. Let me tell you what's wrong with Fred Craddock's preaching. Let me tell you what's wrong with Barbara Brown Taylor. When you all tell these stories in your sermons, you are abusing power. Narrative preaching, abusing power? What is he talking about? When you tell those stories, what you are implying to your congregation is this: I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're a single mom who can't pay her rent or a Fortune 500 CEO. I don't care who you are. Forget your life. Come live in this one. Move into this story that I have created for you. This is real. Your life is not. And we shave off all differences. Now, I'm convinced by none of those arguments, but I am chastened by all of them. And I have begun to change my approach to preaching in response to the critique. And in doing so, I've been learning something from a strange source. I've been learning something from St. Augustine. Not St. Augustine the theologian, but St. Augustine the preacher in Hippo in northern Africa. There's a new book by a Jesuit named William Harmless called Augustine and the Catechumenate, and it's about how Augustine formed Christian community in a multicultural, multiracial, multi-faith environment. And that pretty well squares up with where I'm preaching today. And he says in there about his preaching that Augustine preached almost every day, which meant that he didn't prepare sermons like I do. What he did was to immerse himself in the scriptures and be prepared to the point of overflowing, and then to get out there and respond to what was going on in the environment. And at Hippo, it was a lively environment. The building was large, about the size of a basketball gymnasium, one of the largest buildings we've excavated in the Greco-Roman world. There were no pews. People crowded in and stood shoulder to shoulder. Actually, the preacher was the one who sat on the ambo. The congregation stood. I think we ought to bring that back. And as he preached, they would sometimes heckle him. They would sometimes join in with him, anticipating. It was call and response of the most vibrant kind. And Augustine would respond to that spontaneously. One time, the cantor sang the wrong psalm. And Augustine was planning on preaching on the psalm. That was the psalm for the day. And so instead of doing as I would do and say, well, the cantor sang a beautiful Psalm 131, but I'm actually preaching on Psalm 30, he thought it was a sign from the Holy Spirit that he should preach on 131. And so he simply spontaneously improvised off of this. Everybody came to hear him, not only Christians, but Jews, Manichees, mystery religions, pagans, everybody was out there. And here's the key thing, here's what I'm learning. Augustine did not assume, and I don't think we should either, that he was preaching to a congregation. He assumed that he was preaching to multiple constituencies. And what he would do is sometimes interrupt his own sermon, and he would say, I would like to speak now to those who are babies in the faith. Now, the rest of you are going to be bored by what I'm saying because you already know it, but it is your Christian responsibility to be patient while I instruct the young. And then he'd preach a children's sermon for 5 or 10 minutes. On other occasions, he would say, I want to speak now to those who are deep and long in the faith. The rest of you won't know what we're talking about, but if you stay around here long enough, you will. Now, notice what he's doing. He's creating hearing and overhearing. There are people being addressed, and there are people who are overhearing what is being addressed. And that creates a vibrant listening environment. I would like to speak now to the pagans. I know you're here. I can hear the noise of your festival in the street. I know you're here, and I know why you're here. You're here for spectacle, aren't you? Well, we have one. It's called the Eucharist. Let me tell you about it. Now, I wouldn't want to do this every week, but it does occur to me that we might interrupt our own sermon and address constituencies in the congregation, because even if you've only got 30 people and they all look alike, they are still multiple constituencies. And we might say something like, I would like to take just a moment to speak to those who have lost a loved one in the last year. Or, I would like to speak to the youth who are up in the balcony texting right now. You would divide your congregation differently than I would divide mine, but you would know constituencies that are there. And I want to suggest this morning and the rest of the time, three constituencies that I'll wager are probably present in most of our congregations. And it might be good to think through what kind of preaching these constituencies need that is different from the other constituencies. I'm going to suggest that probably in your congregation there are the disenchanted, the unformed, and the no longer astonished. The disenchanted, the unformed, and the no longer astonished. Now, first, the disenchanted. I mean that in two senses. I mean it in the ordinary garden variety sense that there are people who are disappointed with the church. They are feeling the church not as a vibrant resource for life, but as a heavy burden to carry. And I am including many clergy among the disenchanted in that regard. I talked to a young priest not long ago who said, I sometimes have the feeling that I am spending my energy propping up things that God is tearing down. And I believe that is true, that we do not know what the church of the future is going to be, and anybody who tells you they do is not telling the truth. But we do know that the church in the future will not look like the church today. And right before our very eyes, God is tearing down what we have built in order to raise up something new and more life-giving. And there are people who feel the stress of that. William Meal, who taught preaching at Yale, said, if you are standing in the pulpit of an American church on Sunday morning, be assured you are looking out at a congregation, many of whom almost did not come today. And of those who did come, many of them secretly fear that everybody else in the sanctuary is more confidently Christian than they are. Now, I want to say to myself, and you can overhear this, that in the light of the disenchantment that is out there like a malaise in the air, do not lose heart. Because what we have to say, if we say it in a way that is congruent with the gospel, is so desperately needed for the weary in our land. We talked last night about William Stringfellow, the radical Christian activist who took seriously the notion of powers and principalities in our land. And Stringfellow, in an article written in 1973, said, "How do you hear the voices of the powers and principalities? They speak through institutions, they speak through ordinary, these people are not demonic, but they are the instruments, the mouthpieces for the demonic. And what does it sound like?" He said this: "Whenever the demonic speaks, it denies the truth, fake news. It uses doublespeak." We're dealing with alternative facts here. "It uses secrecy. You can't see all of this. It boasts of expertise it does not have. It uses surveillance and harassment. It exaggerates. I alone can fix this. It curses and conjures. It uses diversion and demoralization." Now, he wrote that in 1973. But if this is the public discourse, and it's not just coming from one party or one place or one person, it's coming at us from multiple directions. This is the rhetoric that is reverberating in our culture, and it wears people out. Do not lose heart. Get up there and speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God, and I promise you, it will be like a stream of living water to those who are weary and disenchanted. Walter Ong, a scholar, a Jesuit who wrote about orality and literacy, and he was well aware of the different media forms and their powers, said this: "There is nothing more powerful in all the world of communication than someone who loves other people standing up and speaking the truth to them in love." And that's what we get to do every Sunday. The second kind of disenchantment is a little more technical, and it's gotten into our vocabulary theologically, and you may have encountered it. It comes from Max Weber, but it's been most accessible to us through the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor in his magisterial book, A Secular Age. And what he says is that we are going through, and we have been going through for several hundred years, a theological disenchantment. That is, people no longer find it plausible to believe what the ancients believed without breaking a sweat, and that is that our everyday life is permeated by the presence of the divine. In the 16th and 17th century, with the arrival of reason, it was, hey, I don't have to believe what people tell me is true. I will believe only what my reason verifies is true, so I don't have to accept it. In the 19th and 20th centuries, it was the spirituality being peddled by the church. I don't have to go to church to get it. I can get it in a forest or in my own private life. I don't have to belong. But in the 21st century, says Taylor, with the rise of science as being the only arbiter of what is true, it makes the gospel implausible. Taylor says most people think that this is the result of what he calls the subtraction thesis. That is to say, people used to believe, but like the air being let out of a tire, they don't believe as much. He said, no, I think it's the addition thesis. There are powerful alternative and scientifically based languages that seem to explain the fullness of reality. I live on the Chesapeake Bay, and many of my neighbors are watermen. that is to say professional crabbers and oyster people. And the older ones are very pious. Most of them are Methodists. They carry Bibles with them on their crab boats, and they, if you listen to marine radio, you can hear them singing hymns to each other. And they are having an argument with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. The argument they are having is that Chesapeake Bay is dying. We all know that, and we know why it's dying. Leaking old septic systems and fertilizers from farms and effluents from factories is getting into the Chesapeake Bay, and the nitrates are pulling the oxygen out and killing life. We know that. Solving that is a massive legislative problem, but in the meantime, the Department of Maryland, Maryland Department of Natural Resources has put some limitations on the watermen. They can't catch crabs on Wednesday. They already don't catch crabs on Sunday because that's the Lord's Day. Now they can't get them on Wednesday. They have to catch bigger crabs than they used to, and they are furious about this, not simply because they're losing income, but because they have a different worldview than the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. What they say is, my granddaddy was a waterman, my daddy was a waterman, I'm a waterman, my son's going to be a waterman, and we've been doing this for hundreds of years, and sometimes the Lord gives an abundant harvest of crabs, and sometimes the Lord does not. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, the watermen live in an enchanted world. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources is scientifically based. It lives in a disenchanted world. I would like my people to be bilingual. The MDR is absolutely correct about what's happening to the bay. They know the chemistry and they've got it right. I believe that. But the watermen have something to say too theologically, that God is not out of this. That sometimes the Lord gives and sometimes the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Years ago, when I was a student pastor in a church in North Carolina, my supervising pastor put me in charge of providing pastoral care to a half a dozen families, and I would then come to tell him what I was doing, and he would supervise me. One of these families was a large family, several children, and the youngest child was a victim of cerebral palsy. And when I would visit this family, they were a gregarious, storytelling, joke-telling Southern family, and it was almost like the whole family was in a circle of light, except for this youngest son, who would stand literally and figuratively outside the family circle watching in. One afternoon, I went to visit them, and only the mom was at home. We sat in the living room, and we chatted about this and that. And then she wanted to tell me about an experience she had had a few days before. She had been in the same room. It was late in the afternoon. The light was dying. She was reading, knitting, I can't remember now which. But down at the end of the hallway in the shadows, her son, John, was watching her. She said, I felt a shift in the room. I looked, and this is what she said. I saw Jesus with his arm around my son John. I looked away, I looked back, and there was only John. But for the first time since he was born, I saw John as healed in the power of God. Now, I don't know what happened there, but I do know the two different things that we did with it. She turned that vision into ethics. If you were to go to that North Carolina town today, you would find programs in place in the schools and in the community to help kids like John that she started as a result of that vision. Me? I had just had CPE. Yeah, I'll tell you how it made me feel. I said to myself, fortunately not out loud, I said to myself, this woman is so guilty about this kid. She is projecting her guilt through the symbol system of the Christian faith. Now, notice what I'm doing. I am swinging an alternative language, psychology, into place. in order to reduce something she felt it necessary to describe theologically into the chessboard of manageability so I can move it around. Now, if her minister does that, think what her culture does every day to erode this sense of enchantment that God is actively at work and involved in her life. Peter Berger, the sociologist of religion, says either people don't have as many experiences of God as they used to, or they have just as many, but they hide them or deny them even to themselves because the community delegitimates them. Now, I want you to look at two paintings. I don't know whether you can see this very well or not, but this is a painting from 1490 by Hans Memlin of the Resurrection of Jesus. Now, you can see the familiar parts of the story. There is Jesus. He's stepping out of the grave. He sort of looks like he's stepping out of a bathtub, but he's stepping out of the grave. You can see the women coming on over his left shoulder, right shoulder. You can see the women coming over the horizon. You can see the figures who are surrounding the resurrection. And in this particular painting, the risen Christ is one among other characters in the painting. So history is happening, and it includes the resurrection. Our people no longer believe in that kind of world. They have been taught, even in popular culture, to test those claims with the scientific method. And when they test the claims of the resurrection in the scientific method, they are collapsing, what Taylor says, two frames into one. There's just a single frame, and that frame is governed by science. And therefore, they're either saying to themselves, this must have been a kind of one-off interruption of the laws of physics, or this is a folk tale that is being told that may make us feel better and give us inspiration and hope. But it's a disenchanted listening to an enchanted story. 100 years later, an artist named Tintoretto decided to take that reductionism on in his painting of the resurrection. It's too dark for you to see much of the detail, but if you will look to the eastern side, the western side of the painting, you will see sunrise. And if you could focus in on it, you would see the women coming over the hill at sunrise. Down at the bottom of the painting, asleep or comatose are the guards. And the tomb area is surrounded by foliage, thick foliage. That represents nature, which by the time Tintoretto painted had become its own force. Nature works on its own springs. Doesn't need any divine help to get the sun up in the morning. It just rises. But notice that in the middle of the canvas, the risen Christ, it's almost as if there is a tear in the canvas. And the light around Jesus is sort of like the sunrise, but different. And the light is not only on Jesus, but it comes from Jesus. And what Tintoretto is trying to say is that the resurrection happens within our historical purview, but it's in a different time zone. It is an interruption of a second frame into the first frame controlled by history and nature. And it seems to me that when we are preaching to disenchanted people, that we can't simply get up and announce the claims of the gospel. They will automatically, whether they like it or not, reduce them to the single frame. What we have to do is to help them repair the second frame. Intentionally help them repair the second frame. And the way that we do that, according to Taylor, is focus on the places in life where the alternative languages cannot contain the overflow. That there are moments in life in which the scientific, historical, psychological, anthropological languages can't hold everything. He says they're birth and death. And pastorally, that's true, isn't it? You go visit a family that's had their first child, and they're looking for language that transcends the medical and the biological. Or you stand at an open grave with a family, and they want something that is not simply historical and reductionistic. But I think there are also other places of overflow. Other places of overflow. One of my friends is Scott Black Johnston. He's the pastor of the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. And he became the pastor of the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City in August of 2008. August of 2008. In October of 2008, the world came apart economically. And he had a church that went into full-bore panic. They had already gone into debt. They had lost some members. They were having trouble struggling paying back the mortgage. And now, he told me, he said, "You think people in Atlanta were scared? You should have been in New York City." They were out on the ledge. He said, "I had one panic-struck officers' meeting after another, and they would always end the same way." All right. I think we've cut it now. We can handle it, but as long as another shoe doesn't drop. And then within a few days, the economy would cycle down and another shoe would drop. Another meeting. All right, I think we've cut it to the bone. Maybe we can make it as long as another shoe doesn't drop. Scott said, I was being a good pastor to them. I was calming them down. I was praying with them and for them. But one afternoon in my office, I lost it. He said, "I got scared. I'm going to fail at this. They're going to fail. We aren't going to make it." He said, "My head dropped down on my desk, and I blurted out a spontaneous prayer, and it was, 'God, please, no more shoes, no more shoes.'" Immediately, there was a knock at my door. It was the sexton. "Dr. Johnston, I think you better come down right now to the overnight shelter." They have a little homeless shelter in the church. He got up thinking, "What fresh hell is this?" Went down to the homeless shelter, and sure enough, there were two New York City uniformed police officers down there. "What can I do for you, officers?" "We have just raided an illegal factory in Brooklyn. They were making counterfeit Timberland boots. We seized the stock. We thought the homeless could use them. We've got 700 pairs of shoes here." Scott said, "I didn't know whether to laugh or cry." It was Peter Berger said, "When a child cries out in fear, having a nightmare in the night, what does the mother do? She puts on her bathrobe and goes down to the bedroom, and she gets on the bed with the child, and she holds him in her arms, and she says, 'Don't be afraid, don't be afraid. Everything's all right, everything's all right.'" Berger said, "Is she lying to the child? Everything's all right? Doesn't she know about what the world is like? Everything's all right? Doesn't she know that she and the child will one day die? How could she possibly say everything is all right?" Berger says she's actually confessing her faith, that she and her child are riding on a sea of grace, and that in that context of overflow, everything is all right. Lisa Mueller, a poet, wrote a poem about this. It's called "Monet Refuses the Operation." The conceit of the poem is, a scientific eye doctor, an ophthalmologist, has discovered that Monet paints as he does because he has astigmatism, and he has proposed a surgical procedure to correct it. Monet refuses the operation. "Doctor, you say there are no halos around the streetlights in Paris, and that what I see is an aberration caused by old age and affliction. I tell you, it has taken me all my life to arrive at the vision of gas lamps as angels. 54 years before I could see that Rouen Cathedral is built of parallel shafts of sun, And now you want me to restore my youthful errors, fixed notions of top and bottom. I will not return to a universe of objects that don't know each other, as if islands were not the lost children of one great continent. Doctor, if only you could see how heaven pulls earth into its arms and how infinitely the earth expands to claim this world, blue vapor without end. To restore enchantment for the disenchanted. Let's take a 15-minute break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the other two.